Next week, I have to do state travel next week, so BG's going to cover for me chapters 11 through 14. So next week is going to cover four chapters, so be sure and read in advance, because in chapters 11 through 14, we have Zophar responding, the third friend, and then Job goes on for three chapters in his response to Zophar. So be sure and read that in advance, chapters 11 through 14 for next week. So we're going to go ahead and pick up in chapter 8 tonight, and we'll be covering 8, 9, and 10. And again, as I mentioned, this is with the second friend, Bildad, and Bildad's response really to Job is he's got to repent. And we're going to see this coming over and over again. So and as far as the outline of the book, this is where we're at. We're still in the first cycle. That's chapters 4 through 14. So when BJ gets done next Wednesday, we will be through the first cycle, and we'll be getting ready to go into the second cycle. There are three cycles of debate. So we're going to go ahead and kick right in into chapter 9. And if I could get a reader, Kevin, you volunteered. Let's go ahead and read, chapter 8, in its entirety. It's 22 verses, so I'll have Kevin start us off. And again, this is the second friend. This is Bildad, and he's not as polite as Eliphaz, so he's a little more harsh, so we're going to see this come to fruition. So, Kevin, you go and read chapter 8 for us, please.
Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, "How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great length? Does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation. And though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great. For inquire, please, of bygone ages, and consider what the fathers have searched out. For we are but of yesterday, and know nothing. For our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you, and tell you, and utter words out of their understanding? Can the pirates grow where there is no marsh? Can reeds flourish where there is no water? While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any other plant. Such are the paths of all who forget God. The hope of the godless shall perish. His confidence is severed, and his trust is a spider's web. He leans against his house, but it does not stand. He lays hold of it, but it does not endure. He is a lush plant before the sun, and his shoots spread over the garden. His roots entwine the stone heap. He looks upon a house of stones. If he is destroyed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, 'I have never seen you.' Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the soil others will spring. Behold, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more."
Thank you, Kevin. Okay, so we begin chapter 8 here with Bildad. Bildad is not quite as polite as Eliphaz was. And his message basically is, Job, you need to repent. You've done something and you should repent. So he's not quite as courteous as the previous speaker. And if you look down at verse 2 of what Kevin just read for us, he says, "And the words of your mouth are like a strong wind." And he's basically accusing Job of being just a vehement windbag. He was empty. Job has wild and whirling words, but they don't have any substance. And so that's what he's really accusing Job. Job, you're just a big windbag. And so basically, trying to subvert Job's words here. The other interesting thing is that he does is he questions Job that, Job has made some statements that God must be doing this. So we're going to see more of that in this chapter. And so he questions Job. He says, "Does God subvert judgment? Do you think God would do something like this to you?" And so to Bildad, everything can be explained in terms of two different kinds of men. There is the blameless man, and the blameless man, and the secretly wicked man. And God is certainly able to distinguish between the blameless man and the secretly wicked man. And God prospers the one and destroys the other. So for Bildad, the question remains to Job, does El Shaddai twist judgment? Does the Almighty switch judgment? And basically, it's he's laying out the equation. Job, you're suffering. You've lost everything. You are not the blameless man. You are the wicked man. And it's really interesting, too. If you look down in verse 4, he actually hints that perhaps it was Job's children. If you look in verse 4, he says, "If your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away for their transgression." So there's a real strong hint here that the reason all of his children died is because they were very sinful. So there's a hint there that Job, this was brought on by your children too. So some very serious accusations. The point here on this first section is that Bildad does not even recognize the possibility of forgiveness. To him, it's black or white. There is no gray. For him, nothing can come between and sin and its consequences. So Job, there's been sin, you're suffering consequences, so deal with it, is basically his message. Any thoughts on that before we move on?
It's assumed that it's God because of the omnipotent power that's happening. They never look to the devil as cause.
Right.
And
we're going to get to that in this chapter because Job starts asking the question, if it's not God behind this, who else is there? Now, he isn't perceiving the Satan or the devil. And so Bruce brings up a really, really good point, and it puts Job really on the slight edge of almost placing blame upon God. And he comes very close, I think, to putting the blame on God. So we're going to see that. In verses 8 through 10 here in this first chapter, he asks Job, he says, "Well, why don't you inquire of the former ages?" He's talking about inquiring, to the ancients and ancient knowledge. And he says, "We're but of yesterday, we know nothing because our days on earth are just a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you?" In other words, from their heart. He's again reflecting back on this concept we introduced a couple weeks ago of orthodoxy. And their view was that if you had many possessions in this life, you had good health and wonderful children, you were blessed of God. You were in a good relationship with God. If you did not, there was something drastically sinful in your life, and you did not have good possessions, you did not have good health, and therefore, what happened, BJ? I just went completely crazy. I'll let BJ look at that for a minute, but it comes to a point where he thinks that it's either one or the other. And again, as I mentioned, Bildad is everything to him is black or white. And so he appeals to what the wisdom of the ancients had in the past, as if what he is saying should be common knowledge to everybody, to all the men. And so that's what's going on in verses 8 through 10 of chapter 8. Now, in verses 11 through 19, we have a series of statements here by Bildad. And basically, if you take and look at 11 through 19 and summarize it, the problem is that Job has forgotten God. God had given him a lot of things, and he didn't give God the credit. And so he starts off, first of all, with a couple of rhetorical questions in verses 11 and 12. He says, "Can the papyrus grow up without a marsh?" And of course, the answer is no. You have to have a lot of marshy water for papyrus to grow. "Can the reeds flourish without water?" And the answer is, again, no. Verse 12, "While it is yet green and not cut down, it withers before any other plant." So here's the analogy. Job, you understand that marshy water is needed for papyrus to grow, and it needs all that water. God has given you a lot of water in your life. You should have been growing and prospering. But the real problem, Job, is that you didn't give God the credit. You have forgotten everything that God has blessed you with, and he didn't even give God the credit. So that's really his accusation here, is that, Job, you have forgotten who gave you all these things. And again, notice all the rhetorical questions. He kind of sums up his thoughts, though. If you look down in verse 20 of chapter 8 there, he says, "Behold, God will not cast away the blameless, nor will he uphold the evildoers." And again, this concept of there is no gray. It's either right or it's wrong. God will either bless you for being righteous, or you will be cursed because you are sinful. There is no gray in between. And this is the theology that he hands. And again, this is the same usual lines of orthodoxy that the three friends had. Now, I want to emphasize, this was Job's thought too, until all of this happened to him. You know, he as long as well as the other three men, the wise men of the ancient East, and others, they thought that if God blessed you, you were in good terms with God. If God didn't give you good things, you were not. And so really, Bildad's point here, and it's at the bottom of the sheet here, is those who trust in God are like, and he describes, a flourishing plant. But those who do not give God the credit, those who have forgotten God, and who trust in themselves, and that's really his accusation. Job, you've been trusting in yourself, you've forgotten God, you haven't given God the credit for the things you have. They are like a stunted desert shrub. So Job trusts in himself, he has forgotten, and he no longer credits God for the things he has. That is the wisdom of Bildad. So any thoughts on that? Because it's a rather short and sweet, he's rather to the point that Job, you've either forgotten God or your children have sinned, but that is your case. So any thoughts before we move on? Okay, Job is going to respond in two chapters, and so we're going to get into chapters 9 and 10. And Job is going to talk quite a bit about his desire to have a umpire or a mediator. And what he's talking about is in a court of law, you would have someone that would stand between the two parties and would help take the argument from both of them and make a judgment. And so Job wants a mediator. He wants someone to stand between him and God, because it's God who he perceives is his enemy. And so he's going to make this plea for wanting this umpire, this mediator. So we're going to read chapter 9, and then we'll just go through various sections of it. This is a little bit longer reading. BJ, you want to tackle that?
Sure.
Okay, chapter 9, let's read 1 through 35, then we'll parse off sections as we go.
Then Job answered and said, "Truly I know that it is so, but how can a man be in the right before God? If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in a thousand times. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and succeeded? He who removes the mountains, and they know it not, when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun and it does not rise, who seals up the stars, who alone stretches out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea, who made the Bear and Orion, the Pleiades and the chambers of the south, who does great things beyond searching out and marvelous things beyond number. Behold, he passes by me, and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. Behold, he snatches away. Who can turn him back? Who will say to him, 'What are you doing?' God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him bowed the helpers of Rahab. How then can I answer him, choosing my words with him? Though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not let me get my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a contest of strength, behold, he is mighty. If it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. I am blameless. I regard not myself. I loathe myself. It is all one, therefore I say, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who is it then? My days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They go by like skiffs of reed, like an eagle swooping on the prey. If I say, I will forget my complaint, and I will put off my sad face and be of good cheer, I become afraid of all my suffering, for I know you will not hold me innocent. I shall be condemned. Why then do I bear, or do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet you will plunge me into a pit, and my own clothes will abhor me. For he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no arbiter between us who might lay his hand on us both. Let him take his rod away from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so in myself.
Okay, just a couple things as we get into chapter 9. It's going to get real easy for us to cast some blame at Job, because he really makes some accusations towards God. He passes judgment on God here, and down verses 21 through 24. But we have to put ourselves in Job's shoes for a minute. You know, put on his skin, put on his sackcloth. He's lost everything. He's lost his children. He's lost his respect in society. He's lost his wife has told him to curse God and die. He has lost complete total health. He's scraping the maggots off of his skin. He is in a terrible, terrible condition. And so all I ask is put yourself in his sandals and think what you would be going through your mind if this all this kind of calamity happened to you as we go through there. So in verses 1 through 3, and thank you, BG, for reading that, Job is desiring a mediator, and that is someone to stand between him and between God. Otherwise, he says, how could he present his case? He's talking about like a lawsuit, like a court case. And he says, he uses the word, how can I contend? That's a term for a lawsuit. Or how can I argue without having this mediator, without having this arbiter to stand between them? And one point I want you to understand as we continue on here is that Job and his friends are in basic agreement as far as the character of God, but that's not where the debate now is heading. Where the debate is going now is not about God's character. The debate is headed towards their disagreement as to the whys and the wherefores of God's dealing with Job himself. So now it's focused on Job. They agree in generally about the character and the nature of God. God is mighty, God is good, God is powerful, but now it's coming down to, well, why have these things happened to God's servant, Job? And that's really where the debate now starts cornering, is why have these things happened to one of his great servants, Job? And I think there's a bright spot here. If you look at verse 4, I think when you look at what Job says in verse 4, I think his faith is still very much intact. He says, God is wise in heart, and he's mighty in strength, who has hardened himself against him and prospered. So Job says, you can't fight God. So I think very much his faith is intact here. And then he gives us some examples about God's power being displayed, and that's really in verses 5 through 13. And if you look at verse 5, he's talking basically about the mountains being moved. Most commentators feel he's talking about the volcanoes that can erupt and build an island overnight or be destroyed overnight. In verse 6, he talks about the earthquakes, the earth moving. He talks about God's power is displayed in the storms in verse 7. In verse 8, he talks about the sky and the sea and how powerful beautiful the sky is, and the sea, how powerful it is. In verse 9, he talks about the stars and the constellations. And then in verse 10, he talks about God can do great things that is without number. And then finally, in the last part of this section here, I believe he's exonerating God, saying God is sovereign. In verses 11 through 13, he says, if he goes by me, I can't see him. If he moves past, I don't perceive him. He takes away, who can hinder him? Who can say to him, what are you doing? God will not withdraw his anger. The allies of the proud would prostrate beneath him. God is sovereign. And so I think Job's faith is still very, very much intact here. But what is going to happen is Job is going to be forced to come to the conclusion that he doesn't see Satan. He doesn't see another enemy. He says, the only person that has this kind of power to do the things to me that have happened is God. So therefore, God has got to be behind this. He goes through a couple of thoughts here, though, before we get down to where I think he's sort of passing judgment on God. And that is verses 14 through 20. And here in verses 14 through 20, let me get this slide. Job is actually expressing a desire to talk with God. Now, we knowing the book of Job, we know this really happens, and God appears to him in the whirlwind. But he expresses the fact that he would love to talk with God. And verses 15 and 20, though, Job states here that he knows he's a sinner. In verse 15, he says, "For though I were righteous," you know, if I were truly all righteous, "I could not answer him, and I would beg mercy of my judge." And then down in verse 20, he says, "Though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse." So he knows mankind is sinful, and he knows he has sinned in his life. But he is asking that, you know, he wants to talk to God why all these things have happened to him when he has tried so hard to serve God as he has in the past. And so that's what's kind of under consideration here. He really wants to talk to God. And there's going to be other sections where he brings this same idea up, wanting to talk to God. He says, "No, God would never do that. He wouldn't talk to me directly." And of course, we knowing the story, know that it really does come to fruition, and God does talk to him. Any thoughts on that before we move down to verses 21? Okay, you guys are awful quiet tonight. All right, verse 21. If you look down 21 through 24, Job here, I believe, makes a statement that he says, "I'm blameless. I haven't done any grievous sin." And this is where most commentators agree that he has passed a judgment on God. And if you look down at verse 21, he says, "I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life." And then he says, "It's all one thing. Therefore, I say," this is his opinion, "he," this is God, "he destroys the blameless and the wicked. If the scourge slays suddenly, he laughs at the plight of the innocent." That's a pretty serious charge. "The earth is given into the hand of the wicked, and he covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who else could it be?" So Job here is thrust into the question that God has this kind of power, and all these horrible things have happened, and if it's not God behind this, who else could it be? And that's really what he's asking. BJ.
Question. Is Job blaming God in the sense that the Lord has acted against Job as a form of punishment? Or is what Job's saying more like what the Lord says? The rain falls on the just
and the unjust.
And the unjust.
Yeah.
That the Lord is allowing this to happen, and it has nothing to do with the fact that I'm righteous or that I'm unrighteous. It's just that God lets that happen regardless of whether you're blameless or not blameless.
I think it's a little of both. And Clinton, and then Dave.
Time and chance.
Time and chance happen to all. We know that. That's one of the things we talked about when we started this class, that bad things happen because of other people's sin, your sin, or time and chance, as Clinton said. Dave?
Well, in his comments, Job is also looking for answers. He says in verse 21, "I am blameless." He makes that statement, "I do not know myself, I despise my life." But then he goes on and says, "Therefore I say, he destroys the blameless and the wicked." And so he knows from his own life that God has blessed him in so many ways, and that he's lived a righteous life. But now, because of all this calamity that has fallen upon him, he's questioning, "Well, therefore I say he destroys the blameless now and the wicked." Mm-hmm. And so he's searching, why would God do this? Why would he allow this to happen to me? So that's where he is now looking. Maybe God is not the one that has caused this to happen to me. And he's searching for that.
He's searching.
He's going to come to see. God allowed it.
Right.
And that's what the end result's going to be. But I can see why what he's saying here.
Yeah, he just doesn't know, and he's questioning everything.
He could be also looking at his own belief system.
Yeah. We're going to find Job, through this whole thing, starts changing his view of human suffering. In fact, when we get to the end, he quits asking the question, "Why did this happen to me?" For him to be addressed by God himself was enough. You know, we're going to see that. It doesn't even matter. He doesn't even pursue, "Why did this all happen to me?" It's like God has spoken to me, and that's enough. And, you know, we'll get to that where he says, "I've opened my mouth once, I will not do it again." And I think he's, you know, digging into all these areas. And so a lot of commentaries when you go through here say that it appears like he's trying to say, well, if it's not God behind all of this, who else could it be? He just doesn't understand who else could be behind the scenes. And of course, we again have this advantage of knowing the prelude of On Heaven and in Earth at the start of the book of Job. Yeah, Rochelle?
How do they know who God is and who
I don't know, but there's no, when you see this over and over again, Job questions, if it's not God, who else could it be? You know, so I don't know. I thought of that when I went through several of these sections. There doesn't appear to be anyone awareness of the adversary, you know, of the Satan. Gods are angry. Yeah.
It's like he's treating them the same way.
Yeah. And that's a good point. But I've wrangled with that too, because nowhere in here does anyone start insinuating about an adversary with God. You know. So anybody else? Okay, Dave and then Kevin.
I think of things when you look at the calamity when it comes, be it disease, be it an accident, be it a loss of a job, whatever it might be. Things come in this life, and the tendency is, and I don't know who's been on the receiving end, that hasn't said, why me, Lord? Why is this happening? And that's the question Job is asking. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we don't always understand why those things happen at the moment that it happens.
Right.
But it's after it has happened that maybe later on down the road, you start to see God's wisdom that this was allowed to happen. And it was for my benefit, not for my demise.
Right.
It was to let me see that God controls all things, but maybe I wasn't where I needed to be, and maybe that's why this happened, so that I could be closer to Him.
I've had several people since last Wednesday tell me that things have happened in their life that they think it made them stronger.
Oh, without
when they look back, it made them stronger. So, Kevin, you had your hand up. And there is never a hint, and I've got like four commentaries I'm using to put these notes together, never is there a hint of Satan by Job or his friends. It's always, you know, it's either God doing this or God doesn't do this, and it's because of your sin. Like I said, the friends only have one alternative. God is good, God is righteous, He doesn't do this kind of thing, so Job, you're a sinner. And they see nothing else. I think Bruce and MBJ.
Mm-hmm. We would be in the same position, except that we have examples written for us that teach us how this goes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if we didn't have the book to understand, we'd be in the same position. Who do we blame? Mm-hmm. And we would put our own solution to that.
And I don't know about all of you, but I've had times in my life where I was thinking the same thing. Why, God? Why did you allow this to happen to me? And then later it was like, okay, God, I get it. You know. But very good point, and I appreciate that. It's just ironic that mankind does that. Now remember, these guys that are with Job are the wisest of the wise. So these are the wise men of the East, the ancient wise men. So they even themselves are struggling here. BJ.
Kind of to answer Rochelle's question, this is a much deeper study, and I think it would be an interesting one. Satan only appears four times in the Old Testament outside of the book of Job. First Chronicles, Psalms, and then twice in Zechariah, and that's it.
That's it.
And the term devil is not used. Just the awareness of Satan and his influence on the world seem to have been not as we would think of Satan. You know, we read things like Ephesians chapter 6, and we understand the spiritual battle we're in. And it seemed that Israel and those before them were fairly ignorant. They knew that there was right and wrong. They knew of the serpent and who he was, but mm-hmm. It appears that they didn't really understand his influence. It was attributed to devils or gods mm-hmm. in the Old Testament. So,
yeah.
It's
like I said, we're just hitting the highlights of this, so I just want you guys to understand we're just hitting the surfaces. Let's move on a little bit, because we've got one more chapter to get through, and we've got about 12 minutes to get through it. In verses 25 to 31, Job again kind of switches gears here and talks about the brevity of life. And he gives us three analogies here. He talks about life as a lot like a sprinter. So someone that's running a race, it's over quickly. And you know, if you ever watch the Olympics, like the 100 meter race or something like that, it's over just a few seconds. And he says life is also like the fast reed ships. These would be the reed ships that were used by the Egyptians that would run up and down the Nile. The reed ships were supposedly very, very fast and very swift. Another one example he gives us, the third one, is like an eagle that swoops down upon its prey. It happens very quick. It happens so fast the prey can't even move to get out of the way. And so he's saying that's what life is like. And so he goes into this whole idea that life is very short. And his point here is that he's stating that he will be depressed as long as God treats him like he's a condemned man. He's going to stay depressed. Life is short. He hasn't got much time left. And so he's going to stay very, very depressed because God is treating him like a condemned man. And then the very last section of chapter 9, he again brings up this idea a second time of having an umpire or a mediator is brought up. And the Hebrew word there is moki, M-O-K-I-H. And it's not a judge. The moki was a negotiator. And he was a person generally that was a friend of both parties that were having a contestment. And so he would lay his hands on both parties and hear them and listen to their cause like a common friend. And that's what he's asking for. He goes, I want this umpire. I want this moki. I want this mediator to stand before me and my friend God. He still thinks of God as a friend, but he doesn't understand. So he wants this umpire, this mediator, to stand between both parties, and he wants to be able to plead his case. He wants someone to hear him. And so that's chapter 9, and so we're going to get into chapter 10. It's a little bit shorter. Any thoughts before we move to chapter 10? Because I've got about 10 minutes to get through that. Rochelle? Yes, we know that. Again, we have the advantage of being on the other side of the cross, and we know we have an advocate. We know we have someone who stands in our place, the high priest, and he doesn't. And it's like I said, it's pushing Job theologically in areas he's never gone before. And he starts saying, well, I want someone to stand between me and God. And so he does a lot of growing throughout this whole book. You're going to see Job develop a lot of these concepts. In chapter 10, he gets into that he wants to plead with God. And so that's where we're going to move to next. And I need someone to read for me chapter 10, if they would. It's just 22 verses. Anybody got a... Okay, Wayne?
I loathe my own life. I will give full vent to my complaints. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend with me. Is it right for you indeed to oppress, to reject the labor of your hands, and to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? Have you eyes of flesh, or do you see as a man sees? Are your days as the days of a mortal, or your years as a man's years? That you should seek for my guilt and search after my sin? According to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty, yet there is no deliverance from your hand. Your hands fashioned me and made me altogether, and would you destroy me? Remember now that you have made me as clay, and that you would turn me into dust again. Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? Clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews. You have granted me life and loving kindness, and your care has preserved my spirit. Yet these things you have concealed in your heart. I know that this is within you. If I sin, then you would take note of me, and I would not acquit me of guilt. If I am wicked, woe to me. If I am righteous, I dare not lift up my head. I am Satan with disgrace and conscious of my misery. Should my head be lifted up, you would hunt me like a lion. And again, you would show your power against me. You renew your witnesses against me. and increase your anger towards me. Hardship after hardship is with me. Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Would I had died and no eye had seen me? I would have been as though I had not been, carried from womb to tomb. Would he not let my few days alone withdraw from me that I may have a little cheer before I go, and I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow, the land of utter gloom as darkness itself, or a deep shadow without order, and which shines as the darkness.
Thank you, Wayne. Okay, again, at the end, he goes back into why was I born, or you know, and so we'll cover that in a minute. But this whole chapter basically is about him pleading with God, and you got to remember as we read verses, the first seven verses here, Job's a very sick man. He is, you know, emotionally just torn up. He has lost his children, his family, his belongings, his health. Society. He sits out as an outcast, as a man that is unclean, and now his closest friends, the wise men of the East, are condemning him. And the part that really, really bothers Job is he thinks God has condemned him too, and that's what he doesn't. That is the point that drives him further and further on. He cannot believe that God, though, made him just to end up in this final state. In other words, God, you made me, you created me. How am I ending up in such a state as this? You've got to have something better in mind for me, God. And so really, question two is, I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. So basically, his question is, why, God? Why are you contending with me? Why are you arguing with me? Verse three, do you despise me? Have I done something that earns your desire to despise me? And then in verse 7, he makes the statement. He goes, although you know I am not wicked. So Job makes a statement here that I am not wicked, and I know that you know that. So he's making a statement to God, I know that you know this. He discusses in verses 8 through 12 the creation of man by God, who is the designer and the architect. And there's a couple of analogies here you might just underline or take note in your book. First of all, he makes a reference to a potter, and he talks about the fact in verse 9, I pray that you have made me like clay. So just like a potter would take a potting wheel and make an article of clay, God is like this potter. And then the second reference he makes to God being the architect and designer is that of a weaver. If you look down in verse 11, he says, you clothed me with skin and flesh, and you've knit me together with bones and sinews. So like a weaver would knit fabric together, Job here is making a reference to God being that designer, that creator, that's like a potter, and he's like a weaver. He is the designer and the architect. And so God's deliberate design and careful construction of man shows God's very act of making man was really a big commitment. Job has been granted life, and he says that his spirit has been preserved. So this forces him then into the final part of the chapter where he makes the statements that nothing passes God's oversight. God sees everything. Nothing can escape God's observation. And basically what Job is saying here in verses 13 through 17 is that if Job is wrong in all these assumptions he's been making, he will be ashamed. In other words, if there is some grievous sin that he's done, that his children's done, he will be ashamed. But if he's right, he says, I still won't hold my head up high. I will not be proud before the Almighty. So again, still a state of humility with Job, saying, even if I haven't done a grievous sin, I'm not going to hold up my head high. He's thinking in terms of going to court and having an argument with God, having a mediator, having an arbitrator, having an umpire to stand between them. There's two things he knows about God, though, in verses 18 through 22 here. And those two things are that God is powerful and that God is good. And those he is quite assured of here, that God is very, very powerful and that God is very, very good. And so, and that's in verses 18 through 22. The question, though, that he has is why God... Okay, Wayne?
Am I missing something? I don't
Let's see here. Let me find it here. I had it in my notes.
Complaining again about why am I even born? No mention whether God is strong or good.
Yeah, I have it in my notes. I'll have to dig them up here. I got it in a tablet. I just didn't write it down. Am I writing down the wrong verse here? He asks a question here. I'll have to give you an answer after I dig up my notes. I'll have to get my notebook out. One of the questions that he is pondering is, why would God create only to destroy? In other words, you know, you've gone to all this immaculate trouble of creating me like the potter and like the weaver, and why would you then take this wonderful creation and destroy it? And then he goes back again into this thought process that we've seen earlier of why was he even born. Now, you might remember that was one of the first things he talked about when he first opens his mouth after his friends had sat there for a period of 7 days. Why was I even born? Why was I even conceived? And so these ideas again are repeated here. And why didn't I die at birth? And so he's asking these same questions. And I think at the very end of the chapter here of his response, he again asks that God leave him alone. Down at verse 21, before I go to the place, I shall not return. Verse 20, cease, leave me alone, that I may take a little comfort. He thinks, his basic feeling is God has his thumb pressing down on Job, and he cannot get any relief. And he's asking God to leave him alone. And then most commentators believe that in verses 21 and 22, what he's asking here is that, or what his basically essence is that death will provide him just a little bit of comfort. In other words, just let me die. That'll be some comfort from what I'm having now. Now, we have to put ourselves again into understanding, of all the things Satan could have done to Job and still spared his life, Satan would have come up with the most painful thing he could have come up with. So again, we have to put ourselves in Job's shoes, and he is desiring death. He's just saying, why was I even born? And so this is just a horrendously hideous situation he's involved with here. Wayne, I'll check up on that. I may have copied something from another file. I may have something out of place right there. For the next week, when BJ takes over, and we're just about out of time, BJ is going to cover four chapters, so be sure and read those in advance. It's 11, 12, 13, and 14. And what we have here Zophar gets even more abrasive. So we kind of get progressed where these men start off kind and they get more and more abrasive. And Zophar basically gets right on Job's case at the very start and tells Job, you're just an empty talker. And in fact, his point in chapter 11, and I'll let BJ cover this next week in verse 6, is that Job, you actually deserve worse. You must be a horrible man. You deserve worse than what you've gotten. So consider yourself lucky. Job will spend chapters 12, 13, and 14, which is his longest dialogue responding to Zophar, and then that'll complete the first cycle.
Well, in there, the question, why didn't I die at birth, this is a progression of depression.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's that the way, I mean, if someone is severely depressed, those are the things that they ask.
Yeah, why were they born? Why, yeah.
Why
And, you know, I've had traumatic things. I know every person in this room probably has had a traumatic thing happen, but you've not had all these traumatic things happen at the same time. Remember, it was just one right after the other. And it was very hard, you know. So Dave?
He says, are not my days few? And verse 20, and cease, leave me alone that I may take a little comfort. Job is still blaming God for this because prior to all of this, what we know of Job, he had prospered. His name was known throughout all the lands. Everybody knew who Job was. God's blessings were with Job. So the only thing he can compensate from that is the fact that now all this has happened, God's hand is in this. And it is, in a sense, his hand is in it because God has allowed Satan to do these things to Job.
But that's why when he says, leave me alone, see, he's begging God to provide him some comfort from all of what he is going through. And so he's searching for an answer. And I like the way it builds.
Yeah, it continues to build. So you, as the old saying is, you ain't seen nothing yet. It continues to build. I want to thank the three men that read for us, Kevin, BJ, and Wayne. Thank you for reading. And so be prepared for chapters 11 through 14.
Can you have them read ahead? I don't think we're going to have time to explain four chapters.
Please read those four chapters, 11, 12, 13, and 14. So, because they are longer chapters. Like I said, it's Job's longest dialogue. So thank you for your comments.